Hello, and welcome to the Word Theater Short Story Podcast, your weekly access to the world's best short stories read by great actors. My name is Cedaring Fox. I'm Word Theater's founder and artistic director. This whole month, we are featuring stories by Dan Shaun because he is going to be joining us live in Los Angeles while on tour with his fourth brilliantly reviewed novel. It's called Sleepwalk. Dan will be reading a little bit from the novel, but before that, you will hear several great actors reading Dan's absolutely beautiful, heart-wrenching, deeply moving short story. To get you ready for this live event, especially those of you who are able to join us live on May 28th at the William Turner Gallery in Santa Monica, we are sharing stories from our archive. They've all been recorded live with Dan in the room. We are so happy to have him here because it has been a few years, and he really is an extraordinary writer. For those of you who are not in Los Angeles, we are filming the event and we will be sharing it with our contributing patron and enthusiast members. So if you're not yet a member, please become a contributing member. We need your support to keep this podcast going and to keep all of Word Theater's programming accessible. Dan Shaun has beautiful reviews everywhere. To mention a quick one, the Philadelphia Inquirer says, there are not many fiction writers who can do what Dan Shaun can do. He is a literary force. I have to agree. Today, you will hear Dig's Dean Chekvala reading To Psychic Underworld. But first, here is Dan Shaun introducing this story.
Hi, this is Dan Shaun. Welcome back to Word Theater. I'm excited to present another story, this one called To Psychic Underworld, read by Dean Chekvala, a story about the madness that comes with grief. Thank you again for listening.
Critter was standing outside the public library with his one-year-old daughter in his arms when he saw a dollar bill on the sidewalk. It actually came fluttering by, right next to his tennis shoe, carried by the wind along with a leaf. He hesitated for a moment. Should he pick it up? He adjusted Hazel in his arms. She was straddled against his hip and watched with silent interest as he bent down and snagged it. He'd had the feeling that it wouldn't be just a normal dollar, and he was right. There was writing on it. Someone had written along the margins of the bill in black ink in a clear, deliberate handwriting that he guessed might be a young woman's. I love you. I miss you. I love you. I send this out to you. I love you. Please come back to me. I will wait for you. This, written all around the edges of the bill. And he was standing there reading it over when his sister Joni came down the steps of the library toward them. He had come to pick her up. That was one of the conditions of his current circumstance. He used Joni's car during the day, so long as he was there at the library to pick her up from work.
Hello, soldiers, Johnny said brightly. How goes the war?
Critter said, and Hazel stared at Joni grimly without comment.
And what have we here?
Joni said, indicating the dollar bill he was still clutching awkwardly between his fingers.
A little offering for your dearest sister, perhaps?
She took the love dollar from him and looked it over. He watched as she read the writing on it, her eyebrows lifting a little.
Ye gods, she said.
I just found it, Critter said. Just right here on the sidewalk. Their eyes met. She was still his older sister, though she was also a tiny librarian woman with short hair and a pointy face, and he was an unemployed Sasquatch of a man, a foot and a half taller than she. She handed the dollar back to him. Yikes, she said.
Jeez, Critter. You're quite the magnet for freaky notes lately, aren't you?
He was, yes. A magnet, he thought, as they drove back to Joni's house. That was one way to look at it. He'd found the first note a few weeks after his wife's funeral on the sidewalk not far from his apartment. It was written in spiky block letters on an index card.
To psychic underworld, stop astral traveling to molest, deceive others, animals too,
Animals are not made of hate. Cease and desist. Jesus, Critter thought. This was when he was still in Chicago, still in the old apartment that he and his wife Beth had been living in when she died, still thinking that he would probably be able to pull himself together. He was pushing Hazel in her stroller. They were on their way to the park, and he looked around to see if there were any noticeably insane people nearby. There was nobody. It was a Sunday morning, and the street was quiet except for a jogger a few blocks up. A pigeon rustled at the curb, pecking at the bone from a discarded chicken wing. Back in the days when his life had been normal, Critter might have been kind of pleased to find such a note. Oh, Beth had loved this kind of thing. So had Joni, for that matter. Beth was a middle school science teacher, and Joni was a librarian, and they both had collections of weird stuff that they had found. Bizarre, misspelled letters written by lovelorn eighth graders. Obscene Polaroids left in between library books. They used to call one another on the phone to share their latest discovery. And Critter had always remained a little off to the side, never feeling quite as sharp or ironic as they were. Critter was an electrician, primarily home repair, and so he didn't usually come across anything except bad wiring and faulty lighting fixtures. Several days after he found the first note, he was sitting in the pediatrician's office with Hazel. He was feeling kind of proud of himself for remembering to keep the appointment when another note fell out of an old copy of Sports Illustrated that he was perusing. This was a piece of light blue unlined paper, and written on it in the careful cursive handwriting of a 10 or 11-year-old was a little list. Go for a walk with someone. Go out somewhere with someone. Talk to someone. Watch TV. Go on the computer. Play PlayStation 2. Go to the cemetery and talk to my mom. Listen to music. Go in my room. For a moment, Critter thought he might completely lose it. It was, he thought, possibly the most heartbreaking thing he had ever read. And he heard himself make a soft, involuntary sound. Across from him, a young woman with a sleeping infant looked up sternly. And here was Critter, thick beard and shaggy long hair, making snuffling sounds. And the little mother didn't like the look at him at all. It would not be appropriate for him to start weeping in the pediatrician's office, obviously, he realized. And he lowered his eyes and tightened his jaw, and he felt a repressed tear run out of his nose and into his mustache. Shit! He thought he needed to get a grip on himself. This was ridiculous. Nearby, Hazel was sitting in the play area among some wooden blocks. She gave him a thoughtful expression. Then she lifted two cubes in her hands and touched them together carefully as if they might give off sparks. Boom, she said. He had been having a fairly hard time of it, which was natural, he supposed. His wife had been killed in a car accident, and he was living alone with his baby daughter, and he hadn't been to work since the funeral. And customers would call with their electrical needs, and he would just let the answering machine pick it up. He hadn't even checked the messages in almost a month. There was, in fact, a sticky note still posted above the telephone in Beth's handwriting. Mrs. Palmarosa, 343-7622, her doorbell gives a shock. Which was the last thing on earth that Beth had written to him before she died. Listen, Joni said, I want you guys to come and stay with me for a while. Just for a visit. Get out of that apartment for a while. Get out of Chicago. And you know what? You might find that you actually like Toledo. You can be an electrician anywhere. Critter said. He was sitting on the couch with the portable phone, staring at the muted TV. I'll think about it, he said. You don't have to do this all by yourself, you know, Critter, Joni said. There are no prizes for being stoic. You realize that, right? I know, he said. And so now here he was. It was September, and he and Hazel had been living in Joni's apartment for more than 2 months. And he guessed that he was basically kind of losing his mind. I mean, not completely, obviously. He continued to do a decent job as a father, he thought. He kept an eye on her as she toddled around. He kept her diapers clean and made little plates of food with cut-up fruit and cheese and crackers. He took her to the park in the stroller, and they never watched any television that had sex or swearing in it. He was not yet ready to start looking for a job, but he was helping a little bit with various chores. He rinsed off the dishes and put them in the dishwasher. He He took some letters to the post office and put gas in Joni's car and went to the grocery store shopping with a list that Joni had made up. Though there was a moment where he became kind of frozen in the aisle of condiments and crackers. It was another note, a shopping list stuck to the cage of the shopping cart, roach spray, batteries, watermelon, which really, what was so surprising or disturbing about that? But nevertheless, he didn't know how long he had been standing there looking at this scratchy, pathetic handwriting when a middle-aged lady had spoken to him firmly.
"Sir, I need to get access to that ketchup. If you could please move forward."
Critter awakened from his trance with a little shudder. It was foolish, he knew, to feel so unnerved by such stuff. He had never been a superstitious person, and in any case, it wasn't as if there was anything particularly uncanny at work. He was living in a city, Chicago, Toledo. Of course, there was all kinds of flotsam drifting around. But he hadn't noticed it before, and that was the thing. Beth used to tease him, in fact, how inattentive he was. She was always pointing out the weirdness of the world that he was missing. Hot air balloons in the sky over the park. The woman in the bear suit, sitting on the L train a few seats in front of them, her bear's head in her lap. The pool of blood in the foyer of their apartment, right there underneath the discarded catalogs and junk mail. "Oh my God," Beth said, "I can't believe you didn't notice that." But now, suddenly, he did. Now, suddenly, it seemed that there were notes everywhere, emerging out of the blur of the world. Something had happened to him now that Beth was gone, he thought. Something had opened up. Some part of his brain that had been deaf before now was exposed. It was as if he were some kind of long, dormant radio station that had begun to receive signals, tuned in abruptly to all the crazy note writers of the world. "Please." Someone had written on a napkin and left it on the table in McDonald's, where he had taken Hazel for a little peaceful snack, a casual Toledo afternoon, but now here was this other voice poking its head through the surface of his consciousness like a worm peeking out of the ground. "Please," in ballpoint pen on the napkin, and then "please" on the napkin underneath it, and "please" again on the third. Someone either very polite or very desperate. And probably it wasn't such a big deal. When he had first come to live with Joni, he had shown her some of the notes that he had found, expecting, he supposed, that she would find it as eerie as he had. But the accumulation of these strange little documents popping up wherever he went, all of them sad or desperate or slightly creepy. She was the type of sister who had liked to tell him ghost stories when they were younger, back when she was a teenager and he was 8 or 9. I mean, he'd figured that she, too, would, you know, see some kind of omen in the array of notes. But she didn't.
"These are awesome," Joni said. "I love the psychic underworld one."
She had a scrapbook full of stuff that she had come across at the library, and she showed it to him as if she had discovered that they shared the same hobby, as if they were stamps or coins or some such thing.
"Oh, you have to see this one," Joni said, and opened the scrapbook to show him a note written on a page from a powder blue memo pad with pictures of kitties on it. "Hi, I had cyber sex with a guy named Eric. I love sex. I found this next to one of the computer terminals on the second floor," Johnny said. "Can you believe it? The handwriting looks like she's about, what, 12? I mean, to Joni, he guessed it was something a bit like gossip, mildly titillating, something like a glimpse into a window across the street or an overheard conversation at a restaurant. You know, how weird people were. Her eyes got a kind of conspiratorial glint. "I love that it's written in pink ink," Joni said. "It's probably one of those strawberry-scented markers." "Yeah," Critter said. "Ha ha." They were sitting at the kitchen table together, and Joni had opened a 40-ounce bottle of beer, which she poured into 2 highball glasses. He lifted the glass to his lips. How to explain that he was afraid? How to explain that it felt as if these notes were like the stories she used to tell him about ghostly hands that reached up to grasp your wrist when you weren't expecting it? Hands that tightened and wouldn't let free.
"What?" Joni said. "What are you thinking?" When Beth was killed, she was reading. It was around 4 of a Thursday afternoon. School was done, and she was on her way to pick up Hazel at daycare, hurrying down the sidewalk toward the bus stop. Walking and reading, which he always warned her about, her feet moving automatically beneath her as she flipped through a stack of quizzes that her students had taken in preparation for their sixth grade proficiency. What is a hypothesis? What is the relationship between a food chain and a food web? What holds the solar system together? And then she'd taken a step out into the street without looking. That is what the police said. Step out into the street without looking both ways. The practice test fanned out, flew up, fluttering, and were carried away, wafting into the gutters or caught in fences or flattened against the side of a building. He started to imagine this. And then he made a choice not to imagine it any longer. He tightened his thoughts, closing them hard like a fist. He had always prided himself on being a steady sort of person, not prone to anxiety, stable, even a little intimidating because of his size. People always assumed that he was called Critter because of how he looked. The mane of red-brown hair and heavy beard and eyebrows, which he'd had since his late teens. The bare paw hands, broad chest, imposing gut. Very few people knew that his real name was Christopher, and that he had become Critter because as a child he'd had such a speech impediment that he had a hard time pronouncing his own name. Critter, he called himself. Critter, he said, and even now he had a hard time pronouncing Christopher. Even now, at age 29, he stumbled over the syllables. There was still a slight lisp and sputter as he spoke his own name. Christopher Dremley, even when he pronounced it slowly. He dreaded the various official encounters, banks and government offices, doctors, policemen, the man at the funeral home, which was always the worst time to try to force that hated name out of his mouth. It was terrible, exposed sort of feeling. He was a very private person. Beth used to tease him. She thought it was funny. All the things that he felt uncomfortable about, all the stuff he thought of as personal. He disliked being barefoot. He hated to talk on cell phones when other people could overhear him. He didn't like to sit in the window of the L train where people from the street could see him as he glided past. My poor, shy man, Beth murmured, and he blushed when she kissed him in public. He would never, ever have written a note for people to find lying around the library or the sidewalk. It would have seemed grotesque to him. Maybe that was what bothered him so much about these things that he kept coming across. He had the image of his own personal thoughts softly detaching and carried off by the wind like dandelion seeds floating through the city. That was one of the things that grief felt like, he thought. Astral traveling, he thought. And now, as if the notes themselves were not enough? Lately, he had begun to imagine that he saw notes that weren't even there. I mean, they weren't hallucinations, not exactly, just little misfires, he guessed. Like, for example, one day he and Hazel were walking to the grocery store, you know, to get a few things that Joni had listed for him. He was pushing Hazel's stroller down the shady block, and she was quiet, fingering her teething ring. And then he hesitated, stiffened. He could see a piece of paper that had been stapled to the side of a tree. You see? It said in big capital letters. And then when he got closer, he realized that he was just imagining things. It actually said yard sale. And then there was another time when he thought he saw something written in the mud outside of the library where Joni worked. He glanced down to the bare corner of the lawn where the grass had been worn off, and it looked for a moment as if someone had printed something there. I'm watching Eve. And that's what it looked like at first. And then when he looked closer, he saw that it wasn't words at all, not English words at least, some kind of Chinese characters, he thought. But no, it wasn't that either. It was just the tracks of birds, pigeons probably, their three-toed feet marking a line across the wet ground. He was surprised by the disappointment that settled over him. Nothing, he thought, and his throat tightened. Nothing. Nothing. If the world was trying to send him a message, what was it? It was a little after midnight, and he sat there in his room in the dark, the guest room in Joni's apartment, staring out of the window while against the opposite wall, Hazel was asleep in her crib, her face leaned gently against the wooden bars. There was nothing to look at outside the window, but he kept looking. The sky was starless and purple-gray, and the silhouettes of tree boughs reached up into it. On the roof of the building next door lay a mummified newspaper. He'd noticed it before during the day, still rolled and rubber-banded but slowly decaying. And now he could only see the dark, curled shape of it, a little bundle resting there. Through a gap in the trees and buildings, he could see a sliver of a busier street, the red lights of cars sliding past and then disappearing. If you have a message for me, he thought, what is it? I mean, there was the wall across the street with the lines running between the bricks and T's and L's and H's and I's. There were the strings of high wires that ran from the buildings and connected to poles and then to other buildings and then to poles again. There were the gestures of tree branches and the smattering of leaves running together down the middle of the street in a formation like birds or football players. You might be able to read such things. Maybe. Someone might. Not him. He wondered. He was not the man he had been anymore. He thought, well, you are still you, but changing fast. It seemed so obvious once he thought it. But still, the idea sent a little shudder through him. He would never be the same person. And he would never be able to go back. He could imagine himself the way that he had once been just 5 or 6 months ago. What would he have thought driving by down there on the street, glancing up to see a big bearded man sitting at the third floor window of an apartment building, a grown man, almost 30 years old, peering out at the street, mumbling to himself? He would not have recognized himself. Bent over a dollar bill that he'd spread out on the sill of a window, carefully writing with a pen. What a weirdo, he would have thought, as the man held this note out in the air, letting the wind take it from his fingers. I mean, back then, he probably wouldn't have even noticed. He wouldn't have been looking up towards the windows, and he certainly wouldn't have seen the dollar bill lift up in a gust of autumn wind, carried off with a few leaves and scraps, off to join the others in their conversations. All the little messages that the world was bearing away.
We hope you've enjoyed Dean Chickfala's reading of Dan Shaun's To Psychic Underworld. Assuming you have, I want to send you off to bookshop.org/shop/wordtheater. I hope you pick up all 4 of Dan's novels, including his newest, Sleepwalk, and his collections of short stories are simply sublime. If you'd like to know more about our live event, please visit wordtheater.org/events. Plus, if you're interested in making a donation in order to be invited to an intimate dinner with Dan and the actors after the performance, please email admin@wordtheater.org. Thanks, everyone, for tuning into this week's episode. Thank you, Jonathan Sachs, for composing our theme music. Thank you to our podcast editor, Jonathan Escobedo. And thank you to our media coordinator, Gina Fontanesi. This is Cedaring Fox in Los Angeles. Until next week, when we bring you more Dan Shaun stories, signing off.